purpose of today's talk is basically to give you sort of an overview of what myelodysplastic syndrome, or MDS, is from a patient's perspective, and also to give you some light on some of the new trends that are occurring in MDS, especially with drug development. And I'll also share with you some of the local trials here that we are doing based on some new data. And then at the end of the talk, you know, I'm happy to take questions. I do have a confession to make, and that is I have to take my daughter for a soccer game after this. So please, I apologize if I leave after my talk, but that's my commitment to her. So I apologize again. But I'm open to any questions anytime, and you guys have my contact to call or email me. So the title of the talk is Optimizing Patient Outcomes. These slides were actually put together by a number of experts, and these are sponsored by the Clinical Care Options. And I do want to confess, I do want to acknowledge some of the experts who were behind this slides. One of them is a good friend of mine, and we trained together in Chicago, Dr. Verma, and I extend my gratitude to him for sending some of the slides for this presentation. So this is the overview of the program today. We'll talk about MDS classification and share some data on cytogenetics, or also known as chromosomal anomalies, and then talk a little bit about the options for lower risk MDS. I'll explain to you today what it means and the difference between lower risk MDS and higher risk MDS. We'll talk about some of the new treatment options for high-risk MDS, and lastly, also discuss some supportive care measures in patients with myelodysplastic syndrome. So topic one is, how is MDS classified? MDS is basically a hodgepodge of various diseases, you know, that get termed as myelodysplastic syndrome. And how do we distinguish different diseases in MDS, and what is the significance of the chromosomal study? So the overview slide here covers all the important aspects of MDS. MDS is a malignant hematopoietic disorder. Some patients ask me if I have a cancer, and my answer usually is yes, this is cancer. Prior to you know, in the 1960s, when MDS was not recognized as a cancer, the incidence of MDS in the United States was 60 cases, okay? And now we know that, you know, now that we have started coding these cases as cancers, we have a true measure of the overall incidence and prevalence of this disease. So it's characterized by bone marrow failure. That's one of the pathognomic findings of MDS. The bone marrow stops producing blood, and that results in low blood counts. And when the blood counts go low, patients are susceptible to complications such as bleeding due to low platelets, fatigue due to anemia, and infections due to low white cell count. Anemia, however, is the most common presentation. So the majority of patients present with anemia. And this is actually a sign that should prompt referral to a hematologist by the general care providers. And if you're not getting a referral, you can actually contact the specialist directly. The key finding of this anemia is that these cells are actually bigger. They're large in size. And one of the reports in the CBC measures the size of the red cells. It's called MCV. So if you have anemia with elevated MCV, then you should be evaluated by a hematologist. The hematologist then would do a bone marrow biopsy to find out why a patient is anemic. And without a bone marrow biopsy, it's possible to make a diagnosis of MDS, but I'll tell you why bone marrow is an important test for the diagnosis of MDS. So by bone marrow, the appearance would be abnormal. Under the microscope, these cells look abnormal. And some of the cells are highlighted here. And basically, you can take my word that these are abnormal cells based on their appearance. They appear larger in size compared to normal cells. And sometimes there is an increased clone, or leukemia clone. And the maturation, the cells, they mature within the bone marrow from early precursor cells to mature cells. And that whole maturation process is aberrant in MDS. So the factory of blood production is impaired in MDS. And then in patients who have a higher burden of leukemia in their bone marrow, they have the risk of progressing into acute myeloid leukemia, which is a lethal disease. And what makes it even more lethal in patients who have MDS is because the treatment results or the treatment outcomes are very poor for patients who present with AML that evolved from a pre-existing MDS. So as I said before, in the 60s, there were just a handful of cases. Now, the overall incidence is anywhere from 3.7 to 5 cases per 100,000. About 10,000 new cases are diagnosed in the United States. However, this is still an underdiagnosed disease. Many patients actually do not get the referrals in a timely manner for anemia, low blood counts. So the overall estimate is that about 37,000 to 48,000 patients are probably living with myelodysplastic syndrome. The median age is 70 years. So patients often ask me, why did I get this disease? The answer is, we do not know why, but it's likely because of your age. It's a disease that affects the elderly. The median age being 70, the incidence rises with advancing years. So above 75, for example, the incidence is 34 to 50 cases per 100,000. And this is important to remember because there's almost 10 times the number of cases that are diagnosed in patients who are 75 or above. And again, this is something that I definitely emphasize to all my trainees and to my referral docs. This is well illustrated in this slide, and you can see that with age 50 to 59, the incidence is about 2.5 cases per 100,000. 60 to 69, 9 cases per 100,000. It goes up substantially between 70 to 79, and about 80, almost 50 cases per 100,000. So anemia, low blood counts in this age group should be investigated. So the most common presentation, as I said before, is cytopenia, also known as low blood counts. Diagnosis requires a blood examination, so anytime a patient walks in, we look at their peripheral smear. A CBC should be done, and the hematologist or the pathologist would then look at the blood smear, and that basic evaluation then prompts a bone marrow biopsy, an aspirate. And why is it important? Because we can actually measure the chromosomes, the structure of chromosomes by doing a bone marrow biopsy. Because to measure chromosomes, we need to capture, we need to study the progenitor cells, the early phase cells, which are usually absent in blood. So that's why we depend on a bone marrow aspirate to capture those early phase cells, and we incubate them, we grow them in a culture dish, and then we look at their chromosomes. And this is one of the vital tests that's often not done. That's because bone marrow, there is reluctance in doing bone marrow aspirate and biopsy. I find it very difficult to accept the diagnosis of MDS without a proper bone marrow aspirate biopsy and cytogenetics. And if patients come to me for an opinion, I basically tell them that without those three tests, it's impossible for me to make a intelligent recommendation. So for diagnosis, we require demonstration of dysplastic or abnormal features in one or more cell line. And this is the complicated schema of myelodysplastic classification proposed by the World Health Organization in 2008. A couple of things I want to point out. One is that you can see there are different terms, all that come under the diagnosis of MDS. If you have one lineage involvement, then it's known as unilineage dysplasia. If there are multiple lineage or multiple low blood counts, then it's known as multilineage dysplasia. There is a very specific entity called as ring sideroblast, which is defined by the appearance of red cells or precursor red cells under the microscope, where the iron incorporation into hemoglobin synthesis is impaired. So that leads to accumulation of iron in these cells, and that has a very characteristic appearance. So that's termed as RARS, refractory anemia with ring sideroblast. This is actually an important entity to recognize now because of some of the new therapies that are coming out, and those tend to have very, very good response in patients who have RARS. Once the leukemia clone starts expanding, we divide MDS into two categories, one and two. Patients who have about 5 to 10% leukemia cells in their bone marrow are known as refractory anemia with excess blast type 1. And once it exceeds 10%, 11 to 20% range is termed as RAEB type 2. This is a very important entity to recognize. Again, this is why we need a bone marrow biopsy, because the chromosome 5, once it gets affected, once the long arm of chromosome 5 is affected, so we have two arms in a chromosome, short arm and a long arm. And in 5q, the long arm of chromosome 5 is deleted. And once that is missing, a lot of key genes that are involved in blood production are impaired. So those genes are missing, and that's what leads to anemia and low blood counts. There is more and more recognition of childhood myelodysplastic syndrome. So even children can present with low blood counts, and they should be investigated for MDS. And there is this rare but an increasingly recognizable entity where the bone marrow blasts are less than 5% in bone marrow, but in blood, the blasts are greater than 2 or equal to 2. So that's, again, an entity that should be recognized as an MDS, even in the absence of leukemia in bone marrow. This is a very complicated slide, but very simplistically speaking, the chromosome analysis is done by an expert pathologist, and then they figure out whether any parts of the chromosomes are missing. When some parts of the chromosomes are missing, it's given a minus number. So that means that a part of the chromosome is missing. When there is a translocation, meaning that some of the genetic elements are translocated from one chromosome to the other chromosome, that's known as balanced translocation. So you'll see these numbers like 1116, 321. That means that there's been some genetic transfer or material transfer between the two parts, between two chromosomes. And once patients have greater than or equal to 3 chromosomal changes, that's termed as complex karyotype or complex anomaly. So these are some of the things that we look at very, very carefully, and hence a bone marrow biopsy is very essential to find out whether patients have any of these chromosomal changes. Dr. Greenberg, one of the pioneers in MDS research and therapy advances, came up with this very simple classification in 1997 when I was still in training. And, you know, it basically divides MDS into 4 different categories. And the classification is dependent on bone marrow blasts, so hence a bone marrow biopsy is needed. Karyotype, also known as chromosome analysis. Again, that's why we need a bone marrow biopsy. And the cytopenias can be detected or can be calculated by just blood tests. So that's why we need a blood analysis and also a bone marrow biopsy to divide patients into low risk, intermediate 1, intermediate 2, and high. Now look at this survival. for intermediate high-risk MDS. It's 4 months. So in patients who have bad chromosome structures and increased number of leukemia burden in their bone marrow, 11 to 20% or 21 to 30%, their survival is actually worse than a lung cancer patient. Okay, lung cancer patients who have stage 4 disease often live about a year or longer. Patients who have high-risk MDS live for about 4 months. Okay, that's an important entity to recognize. And I talked to you about low-risk and high-risk MDS. Patients who have low or intermediate 1 group IPSS are categorized as low-risk MDS. Those who have intermediate 2 or high, given their short lifespan, are categorized as high-risk MDS. So that's how we differentiate low versus high-risk. Again, the key points are bone marrow blasts, chromosome analysis, and blood, the number of low blood counts. So those are the three elements used to classify MDS. More recently, the Germans and a consortium of U.S. investigators have found out that, you know, this chromosomal analysis is getting more and more sophisticated. So now they have categorized chromosomes that are very good, associated with very good prognosis, intermediate, poor, and very poor. So again, this should again emphasize the need for bone marrow testing to evaluate chromosomes. And in doing this analysis, they have further divided MDS into different categories. They have looked at the cytogenetics or chromosomes. They have looked at the bone marrow blasts. And in this new classification, the bone marrow blasts are, you know, further categorized. So you get points. You get no points if it's less than or equal to 2% in bone marrow. If it's greater than or equal to 2 or less than 5, you get 1 point, and so on. So points are granted for patients who have more number of leukemia cells in their bone marrow. Depending on the degree of anemia, so hemoglobin gives us the degree of anemia. If it's less than 8, you get more points. If it's greater than about 10, you get 0 points. Platelets, again, these are the cells that are important to clot, make the blood clot. And if it's less than 50, you get more points. If it's greater than 100, you get no points. And the neutrophil count, these are the cells that are the fighter cells. They help us fight off an infection. If it's less than 800, you get 0.5 points. If it's above 800, you get 0 points. So this is the analysis that we use to divide MDS into different categories. And under this new classification, or revised IPSS classification, we have you know, 5 different categories of MDS. Very low, when the score is less than equal to 1.5. Low, when it's between 1.5 to 3. When greater than 3 to 4.5, intermediate. Greater than 4.5 to 6, high. And greater than 6, very high. So this is how it's further refined based on new data on cytogenetics and also the degree or depth of low blood counts. So this is how the new plots look. In patients who have very low-risk MDS, their median survival is about 8.8 years. Remember, the previous classification gave them a median survival of about 5 years, 5 to 6 years. So this further refines patients into different categories. And low-risk MDS has 5.3 years, intermediate, 3 years, high-risk, 1.6 years, and very high-risk, this one here, 8 months. Again, helping us understand the poor prognosis associated with blood counts, number of blasts in bone marrow, cytogenetics or chromosome analysis, and the depth of and the degree of cytopenias or low blood counts. So let's talk a little bit about the low-risk MDS. This is how we approach low-risk MDS. I want to point out that this slide was actually made in 2013, but there's not been much change made to the algorithm of low to intermediate 1 MDS. However, this is soon going to change with some of the new therapeutics that are coming in the pipeline. So the first basic thing we do is we find out if there are any treatable causes of anemia, like B12 deficiency, folate deficiency, alcohol, or other toxins. So that's the first basic analysis. Everything can be tested by blood levels. And in patients who have transfusion requirements, if they're getting transfused for anemia, then we try to divide them into three categories. Again, I want to point out this deletion 5q, which is defined by long arm chromosome, absence of long arm of chromosome 5, deletion 5q. If patients have that, our first drug of choice is lenalidomide, also known as Revlimid. And it's an oral pill. If they fail this pill, then we move on to IV or other forms of chemotherapy, or preferably a clinical trial. Our preference here is to offer them clinical trials. And there's another blood test which measures the degree of erythropoietin. This is a hormone that's produced by the kidneys. When patients get anemic, the erythropoietin levels should go up. However, in a lot of MDS patients, these levels stay low. And when they're low, or defined as less than 500, and if the transfusion burden for a patient is less or low, also known as less than 2 units per month, then our approach is to start them on growth factors. ESA is known as erythropoietin stimulating agent, also known as Procrit. The TV ads usually come as Procrit. So this hormone, along with a growth or a granulocyte stimulating hormone, which stimulates the white cells, can be used to address the anemia. So this is our first approach. Measure the erythropoietin level, evaluate the transfusion burden, and if they have low transfusion burden, find out if they will respond to erythropoietin first, which is a very simple treatment. Patients often self-administer that patient. At the VA, we actually ship the drug directly to the patients for self-administration at their home. At the university, however, they have to come here, which is a pharmacoeconomic burden, but nonetheless, that's how the systems are. And then in patients who fail this treatment, we find out if immunosuppressive therapy would be useful. There are certain features that predict, that help predict response to immunosuppressive therapy. And that's again defined here, less than 60 years of age. So if patients are young, they tend to respond better to immunosuppressive therapy. If their bone marrow is less, if it is less cellular, meaning that the number of cells under the microscope are less, then that again is a good predictor for immune suppressive therapy success. And these other parameters are still under question, but we look at age and the bone marrow cellularity in patients who are young. And if they are young, then we move towards immunosuppressive therapy, which is given as oral or IV. And if those work, we continue them on immunosuppressive therapy for a long time. If that doesn't work, then our next choice becomes azacitidine, also known as Vidaza, Dacogen, or lenalidomide, or a clinical trial. So I'm going to talk a little bit about these drugs. And then in patients who have high serum erythropoietin level, again, this is a blood test. They can look at the blood test levels of erythropoietin. And if those are high, greater than 500, and patients who have high transfusion burden of 2 or more red cells per month, those patients are very unlikely to respond to these growth factors. So we look at other options, either immunosuppressive therapy or more traditional types of chemotherapy or a clinical trial. So this is sort of our schema for low and intermediate 1 MDS. Erythropoietin, also known as Procrit or Aranesp, has a response rate of about 16 to 20%. The predictors for response are serum EPO level of less than 500. If patients have a non-RARS, so this is known as refractory anemia with ring sideroblasts. Ring sideroblasts, as I said before, are the cells that have impaired iron incorporation. So if they have a non-RARS type of MDS, and if they lack high transfusion burden history, then these patients are ideally suited to start Procrit or growth factor therapy. And the response rates often go up to about 40% when we combine Procrit and G-CSF together. The approach usually is to start with Procrit or erythropoietin alone first. In patients who do not respond, then we add G-CSF. And this combination actually works quite well in the refractory anemia with ring sideroblasts, which is often resistant to Procrit alone. What about this pill called lenalidomide? What is the role of lenalidomide in MDS? So lenalidomide is a derivative of thalidomide. Thalidomide gained a lot of attention in the 60s due to birth defects. And so this is a analog or a, I would say, a modern version of thalidomide. And it's approved for low or intermediate 1 MDS that's associated with deletion 5. Again, chromosome 5, long arm of chromosome 5 is missing. And you know, even if there are additional cytogenetic or chromosomal changes, does not matter. These patients should be treated with lenalidomide. This is the pivotal trial that led to the approval of lenalidomide. This was done in United States and also other countries, led by Dr. Alan List. And this the key criteria for enrollment was low or intermediate 1 or low risk MDS, patients who had that deletion 5q, those who had a transfusion burden of greater than or equal to 2 per 8 weeks, 2 red cells or transfusions per 8 weeks, platelet count greater than 50,000, and ANC or neutrophil count greater than 500. They were randomized to 2 arms, 10 milligrams daily, 10 milligrams for 21 days, 1 week off. Patients who responded were continued, and patients who did not respond were taken off the study. The key endpoint, primary endpoint for this study was transfusion independence, meaning no need for any transfusions during the study phase. And there were other secondary endpoints too, but the primary endpoint was transfusion independence. These are the results. Patients who, almost 70% of patients achieved erythroid response or hemoglobin response. And look at these numbers. The median hemoglobin increase was 5 grams. So if they were about 7 grams before the treatment, they went up to 12 grams after the treatment. And within 1 month of treatment, 4.6 weeks, within 1 month of treatment, these patients had a hemoglobin response. And most importantly, the duration of response was very long-lasting, over 2 years. The very key, one of the very key findings of this study was that the chromosome that led to the disease, deletion 5q, was undetectable after a few months of treatment. So almost 45% had complete cytogenetic or chromosome response, and about 73% had complete cytogenetic response plus also changes in other chromosomes. So if there are other chromosomes, those also got better. So this was one of the key landmark advances in MDS, which introduced the term targeted therapy, meaning you find a target, you give a pill or a treatment to get rid of that underlying factor, and this was the proof that targeted therapy could be used in MDS. So based on this data, lenalidomide or Revlimid was approved for 5q minus MDS for patients with low or intermediate 1 or low-risk MDS. More recently, last year, the French and consortium of many investigators presented this data on lenalidomide versus placebo, sugar pill, in low-risk MDS, but patients who did not have that 5q deletion. So these patients did not have the 5q deletion, in which lenalidomide is not yet approved. So the clinical trial looked at 5 non-5q patients with low-risk MDS. Again, the same, almost the same parameters for inclusion, except that these patients did not have deletion 5q. They were all transfusion dependent, and they were not responding to Procrit or ESA, erythropoietin stimulating agent. They were randomized to 10 milligrams of lenalidomide every day, versus a placebo. And at 24 weeks, they looked at response criteria measured by RBC or red cell transfusion independence that lasted for about 8 weeks or equal to 8 weeks. If they did not have that criteria, then they were taken off the study. If they met that criteria, they were continued for long-term follow-up. So the results are here. If you remember, in 5Q, the results, you know, the erythroid responses were in the 60 to 70% range. Here, the results are much attenuated. 30%, 26 to 30% responses, and in the placebo arm, only about 2.5%. So clearly giving a signal that lenalidomide could be effective for non-5Q low-risk MDS. The great thing about this disease is, about this treatment is that the majority of responses are seen within 16 weeks or four cycles of treatment, which is again different from the 5Q MDS, because in 5Q the responses were seen at 4 weeks, majority of responses. Here, at the end of one cycle or 4 weeks, about 37% responses, but there was an incremental increase in the response with every cycle, 90% at four cycles. One of the interesting features of this study was there were certain parameters that actually predict response to lenalidomide in non-5Q MDS. So females responded better compared to male patients. Patients who were previously treated for MDS, they responded better compared to those who did not receive any therapy. And if they had low transfusion burden, they were likely to respond better compared to patients who had high transfusion burden. So the low was defined as less than 4 units of red cells in a month, and high was defined as greater than 4 units of red cells in a month. Furthermore, if the patients who were exposed to Procrit or erythropoietin-stimulating agents, they were likely to respond better than those patients who were not exposed to ESA. And if their serum erythropoietin level was less than 500, they were more likely to respond. So these are some of the factors that we can look into in clinics just by looking at a patient by history and by blood level and predict how they're going to respond to lenalidomide. So the summary of this abstract that was presented is here, 26% responses in low-risk MDS, and the median duration of response was about 32 weeks. 90% of them responded within 16 weeks of treatment, and the overall safety data is consistent with what's been already reported with lenalidomide in 5Q MDS and also in multiple myeloma. So these phase 3 data support the use of lenalidomide as a treatment for patients with low or intermediate 1 risk MDS without deletion 5Q who are unresponsive to erythropoietic stimulating agents. So this is the summary of or conclusion of that abstract. And based on this data and other data, we have been partnering with Dr. Wormeid Einstein to do this phase 2 study of lenalidomide and a rescue pill called eltravapax. So the problem with lenalidomide is that this pill causes the blood counts to go down, and that's what makes it very difficult for patients to stay on this treatment for a long time. And as I showed you before, it's the exposure time to lenalidomide that's also important in non-5Q MDS. So in these patients, the responses are seen slowly. So hence, it's important that we expose these patients to this drug as long as possible. So what we have proposed in this trial is, if patients drop their platelet counts, then we're going to rescue them with this pill called eltravapax, which is approved for a condition called ITP that leads to low platelet count. So using that rescue strategy, our goal is to expose these patients to more lenalidomide, and we are hoping for better results with lenalidomide in patients with low or intermediate 1 MDS. So this study is open, accruing very well at both sites, Einstein NKU. Mayo Clinic is also one of the sites for this study. So this abstract that was presented last year got a lot of attention. This was presented by the Germans, German group, and this compound called ACE536 was studied in lower intermediate risk MDS, and the results were absolutely amazing. So this is basically a subcutaneous injection, and it was given every 3 weeks for 3 months, and they looked at different dose levels. These are the doses here, and then patients were followed up. And the one of the key things about this trial is that they actually looked at responses based on dose and also responses based on the transfusion burden. So low transfusion burden or high transfusion burden patients did not matter. They responded the same way in the right dose, 0.75 to 1.75. 40% responses is something that's very remarkable in these really beat up, heavily transfusion dependent patients. All patients responded about 40%. Now remember, I talked to you about targeted therapy in MDS. Lenalidomide was one of the first drugs to be proposed as a targeted therapy in 5Q MDS. We are getting a hint that this drug could be proposed as a targeted therapy for patients who have ring sideroblasts, refractory anemia with ring sideroblasts. So this is where the bone marrow diagnosis again comes to play. It's important to do a bone marrow to find out if the patients have this category of MDS. We are seeing the first proof that mutational analysis, not cytogenetics, this is mutation analysis. We look at the genes that are involved in blood production. And if they have a mutation in this gene called SF3B1, they are going to respond very nicely to this drug. 67% responses as compared to those who did not have that mutation. So we are getting more and more proof that targeted therapy is feasible in MDS. And furthermore, not just the chromosomes or the appearance under the microscope, even mutations can, presence or absence of mutations can predict response to these new drugs. So this drug is now being expanded. They're doing more clinical trials with this drug and a similar drug that's now being sponsored by Celgene. Again, the data looks very promising in ring sideroblast type of MDS and those with SF3B1 mutation. These azacitidine is something that's used in low-risk MDS, and it's approved for all the subtypes of MDS based on data that was done in 2009 and earlier. There are different ways to give azacitidine. You can do 5 days on, 2 days off, 2 days on again, or 5 days on, 2 days on, and then more 5 days at a lower dose, or just 5 days alone. Regardless, it produces the same results. It doesn't matter whether you do it for 5 days, 2 days on, 2 days, and then 2 days on again. The problem with azacitidine is that it causes suppression of blood counts. Okay, so that's a problem with this medicine. And look at these numbers, the treatment delays. Almost 68% of patients had treatment delays. So it's better, I prefer to use just 5 days of azacitidine in the low risk category of MDS because those patients had lower grade of hematological toxicities or low blood counts and also less treatment delays. What about high-risk MDS? High-risk is defined as bad chromosomes and leukemia burden, increased leukemia burden in bone marrow. This is how we look at, this is again a very simplistic schema. If patients are a candidate for stem cell transplant, we go straight towards transplant after finding a matching donor. If there is no donor available, then we go towards AZA nucleosides, also known as azacitidine or decitabine. Those are the two drugs known as AZA nucleosides. Ideally, however, we should always look for clinical trials. So our approach here is to look for a clinical trial. If there are none available, not eligible patient, then we move towards AZA nucleoside. chromosomes again play a part here in making a decision for transplant. So in patients who have favorable chromosomes, we move towards transplant. If they are unfavorable, especially frail patients, then we choose to do medical therapies. There is an ongoing national clinical trial led by the Bone Marrow Transplant Consortium, BMT-CTN, and we happen to be one of the sites accruing for that trial, which is looking at this exact same schema in a prospective fashion, meaning that patients will be studied throughout the course of their treatments, depending on their donor availability. So if there is a donor available, they'll get transplant. If there is no donor available, then they'll get medical therapies. And this study will look at the overall survival between transplant versus medical therapy, depending on the donor availability or their eligibility for transplant. How do we make a decision about transplant at diagnosis? This is very well summarized in this slide. If patients have high-risk MDS, we prefer to offer them transplant at diagnosis because data shows that we can add to their lifespan by offering them early transplant. If they have low-risk MDS, lower intermediate one, it's better to offer transplant at progression. So that's how we make a decision on when to do transplant, the timing of transplant based on the subtype of MDS, low or intermediate high. Most of the data, however, comes from the era where all these FDA-approved drugs were not available. Nonetheless, we still use this basic paradigm to make transplant decisions. What about chemotherapy before transplant? Does it have any role? Does it make any meaningful difference? The bottom line is that there is no benefit for chemotherapy prior to transplant. So if there is a donor available, let's move forward with transplant. What about in patients who do not have a donor available in the form of a sibling donor or an unrelated donor? Then until we can get a good donor for that patient or identify a good donor for that patient, we offer them some form of bridging therapy, either azacitidine or decitabine before transplant. And this strategy has not shown to affect the donor engraftment. In fact, it speeds up donor engraftment. So in a way, we have shown the feasibility, but there is no robust data to propose either azacitidine or decitabine prior to transplant. So if their disease is controlled, we monitor them periodically with bone marrow biopsies or blood counts. But if their disease is growing, and if transplant is, if it's going to take some time, then we offer them bridging therapy with azacitidine or decitabine. Again, want to point out there's not a lot of evidence, but whatever evidence we have does not show that it's going to harm that patient in any way. So this is the trial that led to the adoption of azacitidine, at least in my practice, as a frontline choice for high-risk MDS. The French looked at azacitidine versus standard of care options, including very complex chemotherapy. And in this study, they showed that azacitidine actually was better in the overall survival of these patients. So 24 months for azacitidine, about 15 months for other choices. So hence, I use azacitidine as the frontline choice for high-risk MDS. Again, the problem with azacitidine is that a lot of these patients end up dropping their blood counts. So we actually make the counts worse in the initial phases of treatment. They're low, their neutrophils drop, the platelets drop, anemia becomes a factor. They develop febrile or fevers due to low blood counts. Fevers and many other complications. So the bottom line is that these treatments not only suppress the cancer clone, but they also suppress the normal clones, and hence they lead to low blood counts. So one has to be vigilant for all these. So we see these patients almost on a weekly basis in our clinics, at least on the first few rounds of treatment. And if they do fine, then we increase the duration to every 2 weeks or once a month. But in the initial phases of treatment, we should see them at least once every week. This is the other drug, D-cytobine, that's also been approved for high-risk MDS or MDS of any category. And this drug, for me, is a second-line option because the trial did not really show or did not meet the primary endpoint of overall survival benefit. So hence, I use azacitidine. The other advantage of azacitidine is it can be given as a shot, as a subcutaneous injection. So it's much easier, saves the chair time, much more convenient for the patient. Of course, the skin rash and skin toxicity is a problem with azacitidine. But most of the patients, we can manage them with proper injection techniques. This study was presented last year in December at our society meeting. Very high impact study that looked at azacitidine alone, or Vidaza, azacitidine plus lenalidomide, or Revlimid, and azacitidine plus a new pill, vorinostat. The hypothesis was by combining these drugs, we can get better results as compared to azacitidine. So this was the primary objective. Can we improve the responses compared to azacitidine? Secondary responses were, objectives were overall survival, leukemia-free survival, and relapse-free survival. Millions of dollars spent on this trial. The summary is here. Azacitidine came out as the winner. There's no difference in overall response rate comparing AZA plus lenalidomide or AZA plus vorinostat to AZA alone. So there's no difference. So if you're getting azacitidine, then you're getting the standard of care. You're getting the best care that's available by scientific evidence. There was a hint that some subgroups may have benefited from the combination arms, but that's yet to be seen. We'll see the full evidence in the manuscript. But at the moment, azacitidine is still the standard of care. There was also some signal that the disease-free survival might be better for one of the arms that involved azacitidine and vorinostat, but that data is not yet mature. We'll see in the manuscript how that pans out. We were involved with this study, which is an on-time study sponsored. Actually, I know MDS Foundation promoted this study very well, looking at patients who failed azacitidine or D-cytidine, which is a big problem. Once they fail, then the options are bleak, the outcomes are bleak. So this study looked at patients who did not respond to azacitidine or D-cytidine in high-risk MDS. And I want to point out that if you do nothing, just offer them blood products, the median survival is about 4 months. If you offer them a clinical trial, you can improve their median survival up to 13 months, up to a year. So just offering a clinical trial helps the patients live longer. And our goal is to get them to a transplant as soon as possible, but that's easier said than done. So therefore, we use the clinical trial as a bridge to transplant. And the best outcomes are if we can get a donor and get them to transplant. So in this study that looked at this continuous infusion of this drug called rigosertib versus best supportive care or a low-dose chemotherapy, the overall survival, no difference. So this is the overall survival plot between the study arm and the supportive care, transfusion alone arm, no difference at all. 8.2 months, 5.9 months, this was not statistically significant. And there was a hint, though, that in patients who had no response to azacitidine or D-cytidine, so in other words, you know, 4 cycles or 6 cycles of treatment produced no improvement in their blood counts or their bone marrow, those are termed as primary hypomethylating failures. Hypomethylating agent failure. So in those patients, perhaps there is a hint that this drug is effective. And based on this hint, now they're doing the next phase of this clinical trial, and we would be one of the sites involved with this study to look at the role of rigosertib in patients who have no response whatsoever with hypomethylating agents. So the conclusions are summarized here. The endpoint overall survival did not reach statistical significance. It was 2.3 months, but again, did not meet the level of significance. In patients who had hypomethylating agent failure, you know, primary resistance to those drugs, or patients who had a very high risk MDS, or patients with certain cytogenetic changes, perhaps there is a hint of benefit in overall survival using this drug. But again, these studies will be done in the future to really see the true impact. We here are looking at this pill called pyrimethamine. And if you followed the news about the drug prices, Daraprim, Turing Pharmaceutical jacked up the drug, this generic drug, which used to be $5, $13, to $750. This is exactly the same drug, believe it or not. And in fact, they have promised us that they will give us this drug for testing in MDS patients. The lab studies were done by Dr. Verma at Einstein, and based on that, we have designed this phase two study, again, a collaboration between Einstein and KU, to look at this pill, Daraprim, or pyrimethamine, and see how this affects patients who have failed azacitidine and decitabine. So stay tuned. This is soon going to open at KU for patients who are failing other conventional drugs. This is how the landscape looks. Oral azacitidine or oral Vidaza is something that is intriguing. We just published the results this year. Looks intriguing. Future studies will be planned. Clofarabine is something that's very difficult to administer. MD Anderson folks have shown the feasibility with good responses, about 40% or so. In my hands and the patients I treat, I find that very difficult to use. And there are a couple of other drugs, rigosertib, I talked to you about that. And this study, the next phase of this study will open soon. The other drugs are still very early, and the data is promising, but not ready yet for prime time. What about the supportive care? How should we address the transfusion needs and the iron overload that's seen in these patients who become heavily transfusion dependent? The primary goal is to make the patients transfusion independent. If they get less blood products, they're likely going to live longer, and that's exactly what's shown here in these graphs, regardless of whether they have low risk or intermediate risk MDS. So less blood transfusions make a difference, overall survival difference. This is some of the tips that we use to find out which patients would benefit most for iron overload. MDS Foundation has its own criteria. The NCCN guidelines that are used has its own criteria. The bottom line is that if their transfusion requirement is greater than 20, or if they're needing 2 units per month for over a year, which is about 24 units or so, it's probably a good idea to be evaluated for iron chelation. And that's particularly important for patients who have low-risk MDS, low or intermediate 1 MDS, because these patients are going to live longer as compared to high-risk MDS, so it's important that we preserve their organ function and also make them candidates for allogeneic transplant down the line. And iron chelation has shown that it can prolong the survival of these patients and also preserve the organ function. So I do want to acknowledge the families and patients all over the world who have contributed to this research. I mean, again, I pointed out in the beginning that 60 patients in 1960s were diagnosed with this disease. Now there's more and more awareness of this disease, and really without their commitment to these trials, it would still be in the Stone Age. MDS Foundation, you guys have been terrific in promoting awareness about this disease. And all the new advances are thanks to the MDS Foundation and their efforts to involve more patients in clinical trials. The authors and scientists of all the work that I presented, the pharmaceutical companies also need to be lauded for these efforts, because without them, a lot of these drug development would be impossible, in my opinion. Carol Webb, thank you for arranging everything meticulously, and I have my numbers here, my email is there, my card is with you guys. If you have any questions, you know, feel free to reach out to me, and thank you for being here. We appreciate it very much. So,
thank you. Sure.